You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 87 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
It's our second podcast of the week.
I almost wanted it to be like our fourth podcast of the week. I've got so many things that I want to podcast about.
It's true. It is our fourth podcast of the last 2 weeks. So in case you haven't checked them out, be sure to at some point give a listen to The Year in Music and The Year in Seattle Sports. Not as much of a priority to get to those. They're not as time sensitive as this one. But those are two of our favorite podcasts to record all year long.
I wanted to sneak in a Christmas Eve short Dallas Cowboys victory podcast. I was so hyped from that one.
Instead, you had to clean your house for the dozens of people that were coming over for our Christmas Eve party. You yelled at me for sweeping.
But I also, wait, have I shown you this? When you slept at my house on Christmas Eve because there was so much snow where I live.
That is accurate.
And at like 1 a.m., you were asleep and I was still awake because I'm always awake.
Uh-huh.
And I took a photo of you in the darkness. Did you know this was happening?
No.
I almost turned on the flash. It didn't really turn out very good, but I took a photo of me, a selfie with me and you in the background sleeping, and I was going to post that.
That was what you were going to post as the Pelton cast Merry Christmas?
Yeah, because I thought that would be pretty funny, but just it was too dark.
not like spiritually, just physically it was too dark.
Yes. You couldn't see clearly enough what was going on in the picture.
All right.
But I almost wanted to record. I was so fired up about that victory against the Cowboys. I almost wanted to sneak in just like a 15-minute podcast.
Yeah, I don't think that would have gone over well with Mrs. Fantasy Genius at that point.
We also need to find a place. Have you figured this out yet?
For what?
To put in a Baby Fantasy Genius naming college sports mascots.
So I will be editing that into the Seattle Sports Review podcast.
Okay, so if you've already listened to the Seattle Sports Year in Review, you should go back and listen to the new version. This is updated, remastered, reissued, the reissued version, and listen to Baby Fantasy Genius do like 10 minutes on naming the most obscure college sports nicknames that we could come up with.
Yeah, that were crowdsourced from Twitter. Any other business to attend to before we get into it?
We should talk about the beer that we have here today.
So it's a little late. We're a little late on this beer. It is the Black Raven
Grievance
Brewing.
Number one.
It is the Black Raven Brewing Festivus Holiday Pale Ale, brewed with orange peel, Northwest cranberries, galangal root. I don't know how to pronounce that one.
Galangal.
And a melange of festive spices.
I remember reading that exact description last year and not knowing how to pronounce like half the words.
Eventually, if we drink this enough times, maybe we'll figure out the words. We aired a lot of grievances with each other on Festivus, as all good families should.
Wait, did we?
No, we didn't, actually.
Oh, okay. Our grievances were aired throughout the week.
Yeah, that's true. You also replaced the floors in your house, mostly done by the famous Cousin Katie and her husband, Ben. There were
the
a lot
famous
of,
and talented Cousin Katie.
That's indisputably so. There were probably a lot of grievances uttered during that period as well.
Mostly about you.
That's true. I was to blame for everything somehow. I mean, I grant I was not doing much actual physical labor. I was mostly taking care of your many, many children, making sure that they were entertained during the course of this.
Oh, there's so many of them. So let's get into this Festivus beer. Maybe, you know, even though it was a successful week, generally speaking, in Seattle sports, I feel like we should still have a Festivus theme for this podcast.
I didn't come up with a grievance to air, though.
Is I want to have a really good one, and I feel like I have the worst grievance to air.
All right, well, maybe should we just get into that now, or do you want to wait?
My first grievance, second grievance, was with you asking a question while I was clearly pouring. No, I want to wait because it's football related.
Okay.
Instead, I think we should talk about something that we did this last week.
Including I did it on Festivus.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And that was seeing Macklemore at Key Arena. So first off, before we talk about Macklemore, went back to Windy City Pie. There was some discussion last week about the white sauce.
There was consternation.
Chicago-style pizza. Windy City Pie jumped in there. They were clearly searching for themselves on Twitter.
Shouts to Windy City
nobody,
Pie.
Nobody tagged. I looked through. I was like, did anybody tag Windy City Pie at any point here? No. Nobody did. Witty City Pie was searching for themselves on Twitter and jumped in to just say, don't mock the white sauce on the Chicago-style pizza until you've tried it.
And you know what? I 100% agree with them, because we did a head-to-head taste test before the Friday Night Macklemore concert. One pie with the traditional red sauce, one pie with the white sauce. And it was not a contest.
White sauce was the winner again.
It was.
I mean, I hate to say it. I understand. I'm like you. This is what I have to say to the people who are upset. We accidentally ordered the white sauce pizza. And when I saw that we had, I was deeply upset.
Deeply upset.
Yes. I felt like I had ruined the night.
You thought you had ruined Christmas. And it turned out you had saved it because it was delicious.
So that was great.
Also, shouts to Third Pelton brother Nate for tipping us off to the sneak there at Holy Mountain. Windy City Pie is right next door to Holy Mountain Brewery, so you can get your pizza there, take it over, which we had done previously, but had not realized that you can just ask them for plates and utensils to use while eating it. So be sure to do that. And thanks to Nate via Alicia and Lexi for coming up with that.
Also for Nate as describing himself as a freelance Chicago-style pizza correspondent.
There was some interest in, loyal listener Wayman mentioned the idea of us doing a pizza bracket at some point. It's behind dumplings, burritos, and barbecue in line, but at some point, if we do this podcast long enough, I'm sure we'll get to it. All right, anyway, should we talk about
the concert? We're going to bracket every possible food.
God willing. Should we talk about the concert?
Sure.
It was a celebration. The conclusion of the North American tour for Macklemore's current album, Gemini. Two sold-out shows at Key Arena. He told a story during the show. I'm uncertain the veracity of this, but that they were debating, should we put this at the Paramount?
Wamu Theater.
Yeah.
I don't really think these were ever considered.
It seems unlikely, but that's the kind of venue he's playing elsewhere, right?
Yeah, they've probably scaled down from arenas to like bigger club-type venues.
So sold out the first show in approximately 30 minutes. Added a second show. Sold that one out. And like any of the skepticism and naysaying that exists about Macklemore in the world outside of Seattle did not exist in Key Arena those two nights.
Oh, man. I don't know if I agree with that.
Maybe there was a tiny little bit.
Somebody who was with us booed during the show.
At one point. But they still enjoyed the rest of the show in general.
I thought it was funny where it was like Macklemore's talking and he was like, I understand your social medias. He's like, you've been here for a long time. You've probably snapped a couple pics or whatever. You've probably posted a couple things to Instagram. You've let people know that you're here. And I was like, actually, I want nobody in the entire world to know that I'm at this show. Which is funny that we're talking about it on a podcast.
Well,
it was only at your urging that we're talking about it.
But this is a safer space because this is a Seattle podcast. And again, I draw a distinction between how Macklemore is treated in Seattle and in the rest of the world. Even as someone who, I listened to This Unruly Mess one time and just was like, nope, never again. Still, there's not the same degree of cynicism about Macklemore here that there is elsewhere, but I definitely refrained. I was going to tweet something about like what the traffic would be like after the concert on Friday night. Curiosity about Key Arena handling an event of that magnitude, but I refrained because I was like, my mentions are going to be too much of a mess.
Too negative about Macklemore.
But then on Saturday night, I was compelled to tweet about Macklemore. So we all went as a group on Friday night, five of us. And then Saturday night, you were going to go with Baby Fantasy Genius, but were unable to go. Baby Fantasy Genius.
RIP to Christmas relationship. It's fine to include.
Baby Fantasy Genius.
He's dealing with it fine.
Desperately wanted to go. And so I was called in to take Baby Fantasy Genius and hold him through the entirety of the show. My arms are still sore from it.
Are they actually?
Oh, yeah.
It's rough.
That's not a joke.
Man.
But anyways, so Friday night, the show, so we have talked in the past about how Macklemore's love of Seattle compares to my own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've uttered the words, you fucking hate Seattle compared to Macklemore.
And I had to concede that that was the case. But the show on Friday night, not necessarily that Seattle-centric, all things considered.
I would have to say, okay, so if I have two complaints, I want to get to what you're saying. If I have two complaints about the show, number one, it was very Gemini heavy. Which is fine, but like they were playing tracks that should never be played live.
I gotta say, live they were not so bad. I enjoyed them.
Second off, I was waiting for something. Like, I needed somebody to come out. So Mix-a-Lot, Sean Kemp.
Kemp came out the last time he played Key Arena during Bumbershoot, right? Was that the last time he played Key Arena?
Really, I feel like Sean Kemp didn't have a lot to do when he was out there, so maybe that was why Macklemore didn't bring him back out again. The ghost of Dave Niehaus. I wanted something, right? Some sort of figure from Seattle who wasn't just a guest artist on a Macklemore song. And nothing.
The main thing we had was Macklemore's backup dancers, the Macklerettes, wearing Sonics jackets, I think was the main thing we had. I guess Macklemore was wearing a Seahawks jacket.
Even artists who are not from Seattle managed to bring out Eddie Vedder for most shows.
That is true. Nearly every show you go to in Seattle, Eddie Vedder
is spending either playing at Wrigley Field or coming out at other concerts in Seattle.
So anyways, Saturday night, it was very different because near the end of the show, they paused. There was a little video that came on in the back where two members of the production crew, whoever it was, were saying, we need to pause and show a video. In tribute,
they jumped on the mic?
Well, I assume it was pre-recorded. But anyway, so they played a series of...
The idea was that Macklemore didn't know this was happening.
Yes.
Which he obviously did.
Obviously.
Okay.
So they played a series of videos congratulating Macklemore and selling out Key Arena 5 consecutive times, starting with Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Okay.
Then going to Sean Kemp, I believe. Or no, Pete Carroll was next. Ugh. Then Sean Kemp. Then Ken Griffey Jr. And capped off by Russell Wilson and Sierra.
It was like a regular wee day.
It really was. I don't know how many people are going to get that joke, but hopefully you really enjoy it. And then finally, Macklemore's wife and daughter directing him to look out into the rafters of Key Arena, where unveiled in a spotlight was a banner paying tribute to the 5 consecutive sellouts. Is the bed from My Oh My played underneath it. This was, as I tweeted, the most Seattle moment that has ever occurred in the history of the city.
Okay, so is that banner staying up there?
Like, I don't know. That's a great question.
Of opposing teams coming to Seattle and mocking the team for their Macklemore banner?
I mean, there's not that many teams coming to Seattle at this point.
No, I'm imagining that it's there forever. We're renovating Key Arena, and we're keeping that banner.
I mean, because it's not going to be called Key Arena when it's renovated. That's 100% certain at this point. KeyBank clearly isn't stepping up with the funding for this. I don't think it's going to continue there. It is funny that that's in the rafters now, and none of the Sonics banners are. Just who knows what's there.
That's what we're left with. Thank you, David Stern.
One thing I had considered was whether we should do like a Pelton Cast project to try to get the Sonics banners returned to Key Arena. But now that the shelf life is like 9 months on Key Arena, it doesn't seem like it's worth it at this point.
What kind of clout do you think we have?
Oh, look, we can start a revolution.
We've got ones of people going to pizza places.
That's true. I mean, look, it's a pretty low bar to clear to get them to put, like, who is against them putting the Sonics banners back in Key Arena? Who's upset about this?
Who has the banners?
I think they're at Mohai, as far as I understand.
And so you would want a Pelton Cast. We're just not considering this anymore because it's going to be renovated soon.
Look, reach out to us on Twitter if you feel strongly about this.
Or if you feel strongly about us starting a petition to get the Macklemore banner down.
So it was right there up there with all these Storm banners that are still hanging in Key Arena is the lone tenant that I think hangs banners. I don't think there's any Seattle U banners at Key Arena at this
point. What banners would Seattle U be hanging?
Oh, Final Four with Elgin Baylor.
Okay, so pre-Key Arena time.
Oh, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They may have played some games at the Coliseum back then. I have no idea. The one thing that bothered me, though, is that they spelled Key Arena with a space in between. Is someone who has proofread a lot of emails about Key Arena in my day. There is no space in Key Arena.
Wow.
Camel caps.
You should have been one of those production people.
I really should have.
Camel caps? That means you capitalize the K
in the A.
A little bit bigger, or do you lowercase the EY?
No, camel caps means that there's a second capital in the middle of it.
Okay.
Like a camel's hump. Okay, any other thoughts from the show?
I think that's pretty much it.
It was pretty awesome to see Saul opening up for Macklemore on Friday night.
No, I mean, look, any of my negativity is just because of it not being Seattle enough for me, right? And I would say that my Macklemore fandom was much stronger in the past.
I'd say this show brought it back for me. Like, much like Baby Fantasy Genius, I spent the next day listening to a bunch of Macklemore songs.
Oh my god, so did I because of him.
Exactly. Shouts to Baby Fantasy Genius.
But it was very cool seeing people like Macklemore, Travis Thompson, not Macklemore, Macklemore being able to play Key Arena.
Wow.
Being able to see people like Saul, Travis Thompson, Dave B play Key Arena in front of a sold-out crowd is pretty amazing.
Hollis, yeah. All right, let's transition into sports. Speaking on the Seattle Arena front, not really any new developments here, but did you see that the Stanley Cup toured Seattle last Thursday?
I got an email about it from a coworker and was really baffled for a second. It was just like Stanley Cup is touring. I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, Stanley Cup.
No tour dates. Yeah. By the way, Stanley Cup is not a bad name for a band.
Okay. I'm sure it has been a band.
To celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Seattle Metropolitans winning the Stanley Cup in 1917.
Okay, so they brought together all of the different championship trophies in Seattle history.
That is true.
And I quizzed Baby Fantasy Genius on how many of them he could name.
Like the actual physical trophies or which teams won
those
trophies?
Which teams.
Okay.
And he did really bad. I was like, one of these games you watched recently... Could not name it.
He couldn't name the Super Bowl? Like, or no, the MLS
the,
Cup?
The MLS Cup. He was naming sports that we don't even have in Seattle. He said the Mariners at one point.
Oh, no.
I was like, kid, come on.
I mean, look, this all falls on your education of him, that he knows colleges in the Big South, their nicknames, much better than he knows Seattle championships.
That is true. That's what I should be quizzing him on.
So that was, of course, the 1917 Stanley Cup, the 1979... I don't think it wasn't Larry O'Brien Trophy at that point. I think it was still the Walter Kennedy Trophy, maybe, at that point when the Sonics won it. Let's see here. Then the 2004 and 2010 WNBA Championships won by the Storm.
Is there a name for that trophy?
There's not. The Super Bowl, the Lombardi Trophy from 2013/14, and then the MLS Cup from 2016. Am I missing anything there?
Nope. I think that was it.
Cool. All right. That's pretty much it on the Seattle Arena front. Husky men's basketball. Well, we were at the Macklemore concert on Friday. The Huskies were pulling off one of their patented trail much of the second half, play a really tight game against a lesser foe, but still pull out the victory in the end. Again, because of Jalen Noel's heroics, the UW freshman hit the go-ahead basket in the final couple of minutes as the Huskies held off.
In the spirit of Christmas.
Yeah, the first Noel. Number 143, Montana, held them off 66-63 after earlier in the week crushing Bethune-Cookman, number 331 in the Pomeroy rankings, 106-55. Bethune-Cookman Eagles? I know we've discussed this on this podcast.
No idea.
They seemed to tire in the second half, possibly because of the fact that they had spent 25 hours at the Atlanta airport, the Jackson-Hartsfield International Airport, during the power outage there. And it took a total of 55 hours to travel from Atlanta to Seattle for this game, arriving 4 hours before tip-off.
I'm amazed that the players didn't just defect from the team. They're just like, you know what? I'm good.
So they
went and played Wazoo right after the.
They did. So yeah, it wasn't just.
I was happy that they didn't just come to Seattle. It would have been 55 hours and fly right back.
Shit's about to get real for UW men's basketball. Wow. I mean, they've played some quality non-conference opponents. Obviously, winning at Kansas, playing Gonzaga, playing Marquette, Virginia Tech. I couldn't remember Buzz Williams' coach anymore. But now conference play starts off with a bang this weekend as they will travel on Friday to visit USC, number 38 in the Pomeroy rankings, and Sunday at UCLA, number 52 in the Pomeroy rankings. Two teams that came into this year with much higher expectations. Yeah, I was a little surprised UCLA is low as they are. They don't really have a bad loss on the schedule, but they've played a lot of those Husky-style games where they narrowly beat non-conference.
You were saying that you wanted to come up with a name for this type of game.
I mean, maybe we should go, should we call it the Noel, because he seems to always pull it out in the end.
Okay, I'll do that.
And you know why?
Why?
Because there's Noel.
Nailed
it. Nailed it.
You're seeing the process right here. You have to popularize that, because you were the one who came up with the name The Howlin', right? And it spread the world.
Oh, like wildfire, until the NCAA basically like eliminated it by changing their rules.
They outlawed The Howlin'.
Which was good, because the reason I came up with the name The Howlin' is because it was so infuriating, that timeout, like one-stop play, foul call, timeout. That was the most infuriating thing possible, even more infuriating than the NFL's timeout, kickoff, timeout.
Okay, so the Huskies had a ton of Noels in the beginning of the season, as did UCLA.
They did. Let's start with USC, though, since that game is first up chronologically on Friday night. A disappointing non-conference for USC.
I only look at the opponents alphabetically.
Oh, that makes sense. They lost three straight at one point, albeit all the teams in the Pomeroy top 25, Texas A&M, Southern Methodist, and Oklahoma, who, by the way, Trae Young, incredible.
He's incredible. Wait, what's the deal with Trae Young?
He's like the new Steph Curry.
Okay, but I read a story that was like, Trae Young's more than the new Steph Curry.
Oh, good.
I didn't actually read it. Sorry, I saw the headline.
You saw the headline? Okay, so you don't know how
it was. It was probably something that I would have to click on. But is Trae Young, is he as good as Steph Curry?
Steph Curry was not as good as a freshman as Trae Young is playing now, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't looked too deeply into it statistically at this point.
So you, ESPN insider Kevin Pelton, are marketing in stone that Trae Young is better than Steph
That's
Curry and will be in the NBA.
He's going to win more than one unanimous NBA fan. Don't clip that audio. I'm joking. I'm obviously joking here. They also lost at home USC to Princeton, but they rallied last weekend to win the Diamond Head Classic, taking advantage of the fact that New Mexico State upset Miami in the semifinal. That would have been obviously a much tougher matchup for them in the final. USC, one reason they've struggled in non-conference is because they've played the entire season without their sophomore guard, DeAnthony Melton, a favorite of my statistical projections for the NBA, kind of a GP, if you recall Gary Payton II, like the way he stuffed the statute at Oregon State, that's what DeAnthony Melton did as a freshman, except that he was like 5 years younger than Gary Payton was at that point.
Okay.
But anyway, he's been involved in the FBI investigation, so he has been unable to play. USC still has plenty of talent and experience. They've got senior point guard Jordan McLaughlin, who's among the nation's top 20 in assist rate and has shot 48% on threes this year. Benny Boatwright, a junior stretch four, hasn't been shooting great on threes this year, just 36% so far, but averaging 16.5 points and 7.4 rebounds per game. He starred in the Diamond Head Classic final with 33 points against New Mexico State. And then their top NBA prospect with Melton out is junior center Chimezie Metu, who leads the team with 18 points per game, but has only been moderately efficient given that he's an interior big man. I mean, he's probably spent a little too much time in the perimeter. He's only shooting 53% from
and
the field.
Just wait till he gets a load of Sam Timmons.
Look, you know, this is a team that took down Kansas. USC isn't going to intimidate them. UCLA started the year, notably, with the arrest of three of their players during their trip to China for shoplifting.
Do you know which ball it was now? You have it in front of you.
Am I 100% sure I've got it right now? I LaMelo ball, I think. I think it's Mello.
Yes, it's Mello.
Okay.
No, wait, I don't know if it is. I think it's
This
I think
is
it's
an
LiAngelo.
Ongoing joke.
I think you have that wrong.
Because I think that's how I got it wrong the last time on the low post.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Okay, LiAngelo Ball.
You typed it wrong in our notes.
I really did. Even though I was probably looking at his name. LiAngelo Ball, it's really a mental block at this point. LiAngelo Ball.
You've got the yips.
I do. Only when I discussed the ball, younger Ball brothers. So he left the team before the other two players, power forward Cody Riley and center Jalen Hill, both of whom are four-star recruits, learned that they will not play this season. The team announced that that will be their punishment, which seems way too harsh to me. But
that's really harsh. I mean, if I was those players, I would transfer immediately.
Cody Riley, I actually saw this time a year ago because he was playing with Marvin Bagley III in the Les Schwab Invitational in Portland, which I'll be attending later this week.
Interesting.
Playing against Michael Porter. And
who's playing in that game this year? Anybody of note?
Okay, no, there's no UW-related prospects this year. Oak Hill Academy.
get used to saying that.
Well, Oak Hill Academy, partially because of the fact that, I mean, I guess none of the Garfield players, but they're playing in Portland later this year. They're playing in an MLK tournament this year instead of in the Les Schwab. Oak Hill is the academy in Virginia is the marquee one, and they have like six D1 commits for next year, including one for Kentucky. So there's some legitimate prospects. There's just not anyone who's like really a name brand.
Is that, that's where way. Dwight Howard went to? There's some major player went to Oak Hill.
Melo went to Oak Hill. Yeah. I think KD may have been there briefly too. Anyways, so without those players, UCLA narrowly beat a bad Georgia Tech team in China to open their season. That kind of set the tone for what's happened. They don't really have any bad losses. They've lost to Creighton at on a neutral site at Michigan, and then home against Cincinnati. Cincinnati, who ranks 10th in the Pomeroy rankings, but. You know, they've struggled against lesser foes. They did wrap up conference play by beating Kentucky 83-75 in New Orleans on Saturday, so that was an impressive performance for them. They have two freshmen, point guard Jalen Hands and forward Chris Wilkes, who who are starting, but also some experience. Junior point guard Aaron Holiday, the youngest of the Holiday brothers, including UW's Justin Holiday. And then center Thomas Welsh, who's a senior. They have them as veteran leaders. Welsh, a solid player, has added three-point range this season, so that'll make him an interesting matchup, I think, for the UW zone. Overall, I mean, I think this is a weekend where the most likely outcome is 0-2 for the Huskies.
Is this the hardest road trip in Pac-12 play?
Well, no, at this point you'd have to say that that the Arizona road trip is, with Arizona State off to the start that they are, even though they've only climbed to 20th in the Pomeroy rankings at 12-0. That's still higher than any of the LA teams. And then Arizona, despite struggling early on, is 14th.
But they're getting a difficult one out of the way here.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And pulling off a victory would be huge in any of these games.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very impressive.
As far as setting the tone also for conference play going forward.
Do not make the trip to Arizona.
There we go. So this is the hardest road trip that the Huskies will make all season.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I mean, I guess we should pause here a little bit to talk about, you know, what the Huskies can be expected to do in conference play. That blowout over Bethune-Cookman moved them up 14 spots in the Pomeroy rankings to number 125, which is the highest they've been. And I guess they were number 119 going into the Gonzaga game. Then the close game with Montana dropped them back another six spots. They're number 131 going into conference play. The good news for them is, the Pac-12 does not look as difficult as it looked going into the year. Not even particularly close at this point. There are a whopping three teams behind the Huskies in the Pomeroy rankings. Oregon State, which is 8-4, Wazoo, which went 8-4, and then Cal, which went 6-7 in non-conference play after Konzo Martin's departure. They are down to number 178. There's an additional two teams, Stanford and Colorado, outside the top 100. A huge gulf between kind of the six contenders to win the Pac-12, Arizona, Arizona State, USC, Oregon, UCLA, and then Utah. Those are all in the top 60, and then everyone else is 115 or lower. So really, kind of two leagues basically in the Pac-12. And because of that, you know, there's a decent chance for the Huskies to rack up some conference wins.
Yes.
Despite not being very good. Ken Pomeroy's projections have them going 7-11 this season in conference play,
which is not bad.
I mean, that would still be worse than any Romar team except for the last year.
How many wins do they have right now though? 9?
10 so far.
10? So they'd be at 17 wins? That would not be a bad season.
Okay, or 2015. But even like, you know,
you're trying to name a lot of years.
But in the years where they didn't make the NCAA tournament, 2016, 2014, and 2013, all of them they went 500 in conference play.
Is there any precedent in any college basketball that you can remember, especially for the Huskies, of having these Noel-type victories and being able to maintain that throughout an entire season?
I mean, yeah, it's possible because the season is so short, but they're not a meaningful indicator that you're going to be able to keep doing them.
Okay. But you often see teams who are in the NCAA tournament, and when you
let's just not even...
I'm just saying,
Look, the realistic goal for the Huskies is to get to the NIT. That's a realistic goal.
And are fairly low in the Kent Pomeroy rankings.
Not 131 low. That's really low.
Okay. Maybe that's too low.
Again, as I note, that is worse than any Romar team except for last year. In the entire Romar era.
Is there any chance that they're being underrated at this point?
That's also worse than Bob Bender's last team, which went 10-18 and 5-13 in conference play. I mean, there's a chance, but...
Do you put any weight into Jalen Noel's ability at the end of games?
I mean, it's certainly useful to have players who make all their free throws at the end of games, but I mean, he's been doing this... The reason they've been winning these games is because they're against lesser competition, and, you know, you're not necessarily going to be facing those kind of teams in conference play, even as down as the Pac-12 is.
Okay.
I just want everyone to be realistic here.
I like to meet a guy and let me know what to bandwagon come March for the Huskies. It's like, just don't.
Yep. All right, women's basketball also starting conference play this week. Let's see here. They will be hosting Oregon State on Friday, or visiting Oregon State on Friday and visiting Oregon on Sunday. Closed out conference play with an 84-76 overtime win against Seattle U in the Battle of Seattle to get to 6-5 in non-conference play. Seattle Sounders, we're learning a little more about the schedule for the Sounders in the 2018 season, which of course is coming up so very quickly because the MLS season is so long and the offseason is so short. On February 22nd, they'll play their first leg of their quarterfinal or their round of 16 matchup with Santa Tecla in the CONCACAF Champions League. They'll travel to El Salvador for that one and then back home on March 1st to host the return leg of that matchup. Then just 3 days later, they'll open the MLS season at home against expansion franchise LAFC in their first ever match.
Exciting. Are there players on LAFC now?
There are some. They've had Tyler Miller.
Just Tyler Miller. They don't have any sort of like
who's their marquee player?
NYCFC style superstars though.
I think they might have signed a designated player, but I am not sure about that off the top of my head. So you're going to have to cover as I look this up.
David Villa. Andrea Pirlo. These are the types of players, Kaká, that I'm asking about.
So they've signed Uruguayan Diego Rossi and Mexican international.
Former candidate for governor of Washington State.
No. Dino Rossi. And Mexican international Carlos Vela are their first two designated players. So there you go.
Okay. Huge names.
These Sounders will be seeing LAFC again on April 29th, when they will be the opponent for LAFC's first ever home game at Bank of California Stadium. So
wait, what?
The construction will be taking a while, so they won't actually open their home season, or at least at Bank of California Stadium.
The MLS season is so long that you can't even get stadiums built.
I mean, they've been working on it for longer than just the offseason, but yes. Yes, it is.
Their home opener is happening 2 months into the season?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go. Do you want to do the Seahawks now or air your grievances?
Let's talk about airing your grievances first.
Okay.
I mean, it's going to be Seahawks related.
All right. I don't really feel grieved at this point. We've moved past Festivus. We've had Christmas. I'm in like a more optimistic place. It was a white Christmas. It's a good time.
First off, if I have one grievance to air about that Seahawks Cowboys game, it is that all plays should be reviewable. Penalties should be reviewable. I'm very much for, there are very few situations that I'm with Bill Belichick, except for roster development, how to run an offense, distribution of salary cap. Look, I'm actually with Bill Belichick in most ways, except for the cheating, but I'm very much with him in that all plays should be reviewable, including penalties.
Well, as you know, I feel that we should get rid of replay entirely.
God. I'm going. Why to the entire... takes always so bad?
It's boring. It slows the game down, and they're trying.
You still have the same amount of reviews. You would still have the same amount
reviews. I'm saying, but not if we got rid of replay entirely. Oh, you got to introduce that as a third option here.
This is just like all of your takes are to go back before things were good.
Was it good at the end of the Warriors-Cavs game the other day when every single play got
basketball.
Reviewed?
Basketball is very bad at reviews because there's no limit to it.
It's not as bad in the NFL, but what is bad is this like, oh, you know, did that ball move a centimeter in the receiver's hands? Like, look, at some point, we are trying to approach a level of perfection in refereeing that is not possible. And that's why I say salute to you, Gene Steratore, for emphasizing the ridiculousness of the whole notion by bringing out your, what was it again? Note card to measure the first down in that Raiders-Cowboys game a couple weeks ago. It underscored how ridiculous this emphasis on perfection in refereeing is.
Well, it is funny.
We are humans. There is human error. It's a thing that's going to happen. Deal with it.
For perfection in every other place except for spotting the ball.
Yes. Well, that's the best part. It's like, I'm going to eyeball from down here where that player was down at the very specific second his knee or hand touched down. And then we're going to move over with the chain.
My other grievance is that we should have a common sense catch rule. We should have a playground catch rule where it's like, if you caught the ball, you caught the ball.
If the integrity of the football is maintained. Yes. That was when we were playing snow football.
As it was during snow football. Like, if the ball breaks, it's just not, it can't be a catch.
It can't.
But I also wanted to talk through just our emotions on early Sunday morning.
All right.
Should we test?
That's fine.
Okay, so we go into Sunday morning, and I am fully expecting that the shit NFL season is going to give us a Detroit Lions playoff game. So the gods shine down upon us in a Christmas miracle, and the Detroit Lions lost.
Was the miracle that the Lions lost or that the Bengals won?
I don't care. Do not care what it was. Just not having the Detroit Lions in the playoffs is great. I don't even care. Look, no matter what happens this week, as long as the Lions are not in the playoffs, I'm happy.
Okay.
There are so many deserving teams in the NFC, and the Detroit Lions are not one of them.
There are so many deserving teams in the NFC, and also the Lions.
If they instituted a rule this week, which they're kind of changing the rules around a lot, especially with regards to television. If they instituted a rule this week and said, we're going to choose the sixth seed, and they chose the 49ers, I would be in on that.
Bill Simmons proposed something similar to that in this week's pod.
Okay. I would be for that as long as the Lions don't make the playoffs.
I mean, it would be harsh, but it would be fair. They're probably playing better than the Seahawks at this point.
So we're monitoring all these different things. Apparently there was an onside kick in the Rams-Titans game, a surprise onside kick by the Titans, which, by the way, one of the greatest coaching moves in Mike Mularkey's career.
I mean, not a long list, but yes.
It's number one. Number 1 million is taking a quarterback who is very successful running an up-tempo offense and having him run a 1950s-style offense. But, so I don't even know what happened in that play because I think we were distracted with something else.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it come flash at one point on red zone, but didn't understand the context of it because the Rams had the ball. And it turns out the reason they had the ball is because that there was an officiating mistake.
Do we even know what the officiating mistake was?
I went to look it up at some point and did not.
Whenever
find the
we
story.
Find out what that was, that's my grievance. Because I would have loved to have seen the Rams have to win Week 17 against the 49ers and Jimmy GQ.
Yes.
But so we're monitoring all these things, and then I have to go for a drive or whatever. And I had to make sure that I'm monitoring the Bengals and the Lions to make sure that the Lions were finished. And I'm looking at the win percentage tick up for the Bengals, and finally they score a touchdown, it goes to 100%. I'm thanking God, right? The Lions are out. It's perfect. And so I'm watching on the ESPN app the Panthers-Buccaneers game. And it's very hard to tell exactly what's going on because it's taking way too long. But the Panthers are moving closer and closer to the goal line for what is going to be the eventual winning touchdown. And I see pop up on the app, Cam Newton fumbles in all caps. This might be a grievance that I have with the ESPN app. And I'm freaking out. I'm so excited when I see this Cam Newton fumbles. And then it says, and recovers fumble and rushes for 2-yard touchdown.
Yeah, I had this happen in a faster period of time since I was watching the game. And yeah, you see the ball on the ground, you're like, oh. And then Cam Newton powers into the end zone.
Oh, man. And then the Seahawks pulling it off that afternoon, the victory in Dallas, which we should talk about for at least 1 second. But the victory that they had that afternoon, because all of this would have been for naught had they lost in Dallas.
By the way, what happened is that Walt Anderson ruled that the Rams had called timeout prior to the onside kick.
Had they?
Sean McVay did not call timeout, and was confused as to why he was created a timeout.
Okay, wait, how old is Walt Anderson?
I'm not sure.
He's very old, right? I mean, these officials who are making these decisions are... But look, he's got to be... He's old enough to be Sean McVay's grandfather.
The subsequent explanation is that the officials miscommunicated... I mean, Wade Phillips says, by the way. The officials miscommunicated...
He is Sean McVay's grandfather.
...to the L.A. sideline that it was a full timeout instead of a 30-second timeout. When L.A. was not ready for the kickoff, due to the miscommunication, the officials decided to shut it down and allow for a re-kick.
Shut it down!
Yes.
But then the Seahawks pulling off that victory and actually making this matter. And so they could have gone into Week 17 with a chance to win and be in the playoffs, which would have been amazing.
We would feel a lot differently. For example, we'd feel a lot more strongly that they were somehow going to lose this game to the Cardinals.
I mean, don't worry. I'm still nervous about that. But can we talk about... So the Seahawks beat the Cowboys. Strong defensive performance. Let's talk about that in a second. But my last grievance... is people freaking out. Look, I was warned. It's Christmas Eve. People are like, I don't want to ruin your Christmas Eve, but I have something to tell you. Were you there for this conversation?
No, I don't think that. I don't think I heard it that way. I saw it on Twitter at some point.
And whomever it was who said it was like, Earl Thomas wants to play for the Cowboys. And I'm like, okay. He's under contract through next year. He can want to play for the Cowboys all he'd like. But then Twitter freaks out.
Oh, I mean, that is I think that might have been Third Pelton brother Zach Whitman. Or no, it's Bill Barnwell who said that. Yeah, that doesn't sound like Twitter at all.
Future Third Pelton brother Bill Barnwell.
Whether he wants to or not.
People freak out about the idea of Earl Thomas playing for the Cowboys. It's like Earl Thomas is under contract through next season on a pretty team-friendly contract around $10 million. He's not going anywhere. The Seahawks are not going to let him go. It would not make any sense to trade Earl Thomas, especially with...
Never not make any sense to trade Earl Thomas, but
they
it's not
have
something
to get
I'm
quite,
hoping.
Quite the ransom for Earl Thomas for it to make sense to trade him at that salary number. But also, if Earl Thomas after next season, let's say he doesn't re-sign with the Seahawks, and he's a 30-year-old safety who's probably going to be overpaid, wants to sign with the Cowboys, have fun, Earl Thomas. I am okay with Earl Thomas playing out the twilight years of his career with the Cowboys.
I'm not ready to start referring to Earl Thomas's 2019 season as his twilight years, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, look, people like freaking out about stuff. People want to be angry.
Can I give you a list of players who I'd be very upset if they said they didn't want to play for the Seahawks? They said they wanted to play for another team.
Okay.
Russell Wilson.
That's the end of the list.
End list. It doesn't matter beyond that.
You know, if Jermaine Kearse had said that he wanted to play for another team, I would have been pretty unhappy.
Instead, we did it to Jermaine
Kearse. Did it to Jermaine, yeah. Does this game, does this win over the Cowboys make you feel better about who the Seahawks are as a team?
Nope.
I mean, obviously a lot of it was due to Dan Bailey missing kicks, somewhat random plays, the Justin Coleman pick six. I mean, it wasn't a great performance by the Seahawks in Dallas, but it was a win, and that a win is a win.
I mean, it's definitely, the takeaways that I had were, I mean, I guess, yes, a win is a win, and wins have a way of framing the season or a week or whatever as different than what actually happened.
They do.
So the way that the Seahawks could have a game where they outplayed, I think they outplayed Washington quite a bit, right?
Had a bunch of turnovers.
One drive.
Missed field goals. Yeah.
And we're really down on that game. When as a whole, the Seahawks played much better.
But also, Washington has a slightly better DVOA than the Seahawks. Were you aware of that?
Do they really?
Yeah, they're not a bad team.
Wow.
I mean, the injuries they had, I mean, they've been a different team at different points in the season. And the Seahawks were at home, so they should have won that game. But it was not as disastrous a loss as it. They're actually a better team than Atlanta by DVOA.
That's crazy. It was a nice defensive performance by the Seahawks. Opportunistic. They made huge plays. I mean, the KJ interception, the Justin Coleman interception. Bruce Irvin. Once Tyron Smith went out of the game.
Sorry, Bruce Irvin?
Bruce Irvin.
What year was this game played? Raiders Cowboys was a few weeks ago. Frank Clark, yes, had a huge game against...
They're basically the same player to me. But Frank Clark having the huge game once Tyron Smith went out of the game. But the other takeaway that I had was we talked before this podcast, or last week's podcast, about how Ezekiel Elliott is not a difference maker. Whether he's out there, whether Alfred Morris is out there, whether Rod Smith is out there, the person who makes a difference is Tyron Smith. And I think that's what we saw in this game.
Yeah, I mean, it was really pretty much hammered home by the pressure that the Seahawks were able to get from that, you know, right end spot once he left the game and was replaced by their backup tackle, whose name I'm looking up now, if I can find it here. Let's see. It's got a Bell. His last name is Bell, right? Oh, Byron Bell. Wait, he was in there for 73 snaps, so I'm confused by that. Oh, Tyron Smith only played 3 snaps in this game? Huh.
Also, I didn't realize that. The Fox crew for letting us know what was going on.
Maybe he didn't make that much of a difference because the offense did move pretty well after that first drive, those first 3 snaps. But by as the game went on, I would say Byron Bell's presence was more problematic.
That's to get a sense of how, especially in the broadcast, players are viewed, where Tyron Smith is a game-changing player, right? He's out of the game. We don't even really know for much of the game. Ezekiel Elliott has like a 4-yard carry, and they're like, he just has an eye for the first down. It's really funny. Like, Rod Smith will have like a 6-yard carry. No mention of it. Rod Smith will have like a completion for a first down, and they're just like, first down, Cowboys. Some player picked it up. Ezekiel Elliott has a 4-yard carry for a first down, and it's like he had the greatest play in NFL history. He ended up with basically an average game, a little bit worse than his typical game would have been.
I mean, it's tough to know how good the Seahawks run defense is at this point, to know how much credit to give Ezekiel Elliott for this performance, but Rod Smith did have 5 yards apiece on his 2 carries. All right, should we look ahead to the Cardinals? Who, an interesting week for the Cardinals. Bruce Arians certainly making news this week. First for his post-game speech after they shut out the New York Giants 23-0 on Sunday. The first shutout for the Cardinals franchise since 1992, which is an amazing statistic that they haven't had one in that long. During his post-game speech, we got a big one next week now. We know that's our home field. We're going up there and kick their ass. The Cardinals are 3-1 at CenturyLink Field under Bruce Arians. The Seahawks, oddly, 4-0-1 in Arizona, at Arizona during that span. Of course, they do have one loss in University of Phoenix Stadium, but that game was canceled.
Love that quote from Bruce, though. I mean, come on.
It's like, fun.
Look, if you're going to go out, especially if Bruce Arians is going to be retiring or leaving the Cardinals after the year, you love going out that way. Like, hold nothing back. Come on.
So is he going out? That's the big question. Reported Tuesday by Pro Football Weekly that Arians and the Cardinals had mutually agreed to part ways at the end of the season. During his press conference on Tuesday,
reported by Jordan Schultz. No.
Arians rebutted that notion, saying that, quote, nothing has changed and that the decision on his future will come, quote, between next Monday and February, whenever team president Michael Bidwell lets him make that decision. So we'll see. I mean, we'll see.
And we've gotten these reports earlier in the year also, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a new idea that Bruce Arians, given his age, would be ready to step away. I mean, you know, this is someone the Steelers are trying to push into retirement 5 years ago at this, or 6 years ago at this point, before he went to Indianapolis and took over for Chuck Pagano. So, yeah.
Okay, so the Cardinals coming to Seattle.
So the Cardinals quietly have turned into an elite defense in the second half of the season. Building off that shutout, they are now up to fourth in defensive DVOA this season. I somehow have reversed this in my notes. They are number one in the NFL at defending the run, allowing just 3.3 yards per carry to running backs, which is tied for second with Philadelphia, but they're number one in DVOA once you account for, I guess, quarterback running and then also the opponents they've faced.
Which means that the Seahawks are going to really want to establish the run this week.
The Seahawks had 16 carries for 56 yards at Arizona earlier this year. Many of those successful runs coming from J.D. McKissic. Thomas Rawls was the lead running back in that game and had 10 carries for 27 yards, which is hard to say whether that was great defense by the Cardinals, because that's just pretty much what the Seahawks run game is. No matter who is running the football, as long as that person is not Chris Carson. Their pass defense, though, is what's really, I think, turned around. Their run defense has been pretty strong all year. Since week 7, they have allowed just 5.8 yards per attempt to opposing quarterbacks. They've faced a number of terrible quarterbacks during that span, including they got Bortles and not Hyde, or whichever one is which.
They got Bortles.
But it also includes two matchups with the Rams, both of which, you know, did not go particularly well for Jared Goff. No one has done better than 7.0 yards per attempt in that span, including the Seahawks. Russell Wilson had 6.6 yards per attempt during their win in Arizona. They did lose one of their starters, safety, or one of their key defensive players, safety Antoine Bethea, to a torn pectoral muscle last week. And previously, you recall, they lost another key safety, Tyvon Branch, during the Seahawks game, which was almost as problematic for Arizona in terms of injuries as it was for the Seahawks, losing Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman in that game. It is interesting. The one thing the Cardinals are not doing that usually associate with them defensively, they're not getting a ton of pressure. They're only 21st in adjusted sack rate on Football Outsiders, but their 5 sacks versus the Seahawks in Arizona tied a season high. Mm-hmm. So the defense has really been doing a lot to cover up for the fact that the passing attack has been, just the offense in general for the Cardinals, has been horrendous this season. Really atypical of what you expect from a Bruce Arians team. They are 30th in offensive DVOA on Football Outsiders. They are dead last, number 32 in rushing. Somehow worse than the Seahawks. Actually, the Seahawks average fewer yards per carry from their running backs. 3.26 for the Seahawks, 3.35 for the Cardinals. But because of the fact that Russell Wilson and Tyler Lockett have contributed to the Seahawks rushing DVOA, they're actually not that far below average overall. They're only 21st in rushing DVOA, whereas Arizona is last in the league. No Arizona running back is averaging more than 3.7 yards per carry. David Johnson, of course, out for the season, was lost early in week 1. They traded for Adrian Peterson, and he had a little bit of success on high volume early in the year, but now he is also on IR, and they have turned to Kerwin Williams, who's been the best of their running backs, rating at replacement level.
They had 8 carries last week from a person named Elijah Penny. Have you ever heard of this person?
I have, because he scored a touchdown earlier this year, and it was pointed out that Elijah Penny at one point had committed to UW.
Oh,
before,
really?
I think going the junior conference route.
And do you know where he ended up?
I want to say Nevada, but that's kind of a stab.
Idaho,
yeah. Part of the issue for the Cardinals is that they have been plagued by injuries on their offensive line. 3 of their starting offensive linemen to begin this year, DJ Humphreys, Mike Iupati, who also went to Idaho, and Jared Veldheer, are on IR now. And then, of course, another problem for them has been that they lost Carson Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lost Drew Stanton, who was injured after that Seahawks game and missed 5 weeks, during which Blaine Gabbert was terrible. There was a lot of hype about, like, oh, Blaine Gabbert's going to turn it around under Bruce Arians. Like, it's a new Blaine Gabbert. And no.
Where was that? Where were you reading this hype?
Oh, that was Gabbert? That existed. That was a real thing.
They beat the Jaguars in the Blaine Gabbert revenge game?
No, I mean, I think it was mostly his preseason performance because he was really bad once they started counting the games. Somehow he did win two games. The Cardinals went 2-3 with him as a starter. But Drew Stanton returned last week for the first time since that Seahawks game, and he was okay. He was 20 of 34 for 209 yards with two touchdowns and two interceptions. He did bring his completion percentage above 50% for the season. So here's an interesting fact. Larry Fitzgerald is putting together his third consecutive season with at least 100 catches and at least 1,000 yards, bringing it to five times in his career that he's done so. He's caught 68% of his passes this year. No other Cardinals wide receiver is catching even 50% of passes thrown to them this year, including John Brown, all the way down at 41% this year. By contrast, no Seahawks player at any position, any minimum number of targets, has caught less than 50% of the passes thrown to them this year.
I mean, how much of that is that they're running all the underneath routes to Larry Fitzgerald and everything deep down?
I mean, that
else?
Is part of it. The even when, you know, this Cardinals offense is really cooking, it's not going to be a high completion percentage offense. It's going to be a high yards per catch offense. But this year, they're neither.
I mean, Drew Stanton and Blaine Gabbert have been their quarterbacks for most of the year.
It is true. Let's see. The other thing to mention here, both of these teams are particularly bad at special teams. The Cardinals come in 29th. In Football Outsiders special teams DVOA. Phil Dawson has provided the league's second worst place kicking. He is 10 of 14 this year from 30 to 39 yards on field goals and has missed three extra points. Also, as we mentioned, I think it came into play at one point during that previous game. The Cardinals have a tendency for Andy Lee to outkick their coverage and are allowing 10.6 yards per return this season. So a chance for the Seahawks to have an edge on special teams, which actually they did last week, despite Dallas coming in so highly rated. It was generally a good special teams day for the Seahawks.
We've seen this game before.
Every year?
Every single year we have seen this game. Maybe it's not Carson Palmer.
Wait, is it supposed to rain?
Oh, God. You know it is.
I'm sure it is.
I mean, there was the game 2 years, like a high-powered Cardinals team. Was that a DVOA bowl, actually, 2 years ago?
No, because the final game of the season was DVOA bowl.
We have seen this game so many times against the Cardinals, and we go into it, and we feel so confident. It has such a great magnitude on the Seahawks season, and it's ugly, and it's a slog, and it's raining.
No rain in the forecast. It's unclear whether to count that Rams game is Russell Wilson's first loss in a game without rain. Technically, it did not qualify because there was like 0.02 inches early in the morning. It wasn't really a rain game, though.
He got rained on earlier. As he was walking into the stadium, he was rained on, and that was it.
That was all it took.
His jacket got some raindrops on it. But we've seen this game, and I think people are a little bit too confident about it. We look at Arizona.
The Seahawks
went into Arizona and won. It was a comfortable victory. It was a nice victory in Arizona, especially given kind of what they've put together since then. But this is not going to be that. This is going to be an ugly game. And we've kind of seen some, given the kind of pass pressure that he's faced, Russell Wilson having a couple of rough games in a row. And I think we're looking at three in a row.
All right, chances of victory?
It's really tough to say because I think the Seahawks probably will pull this game out, but I still wouldn't put percentage chance of victory at over 55%.
I was going to go 60, so I guess I'm relatively optimistic.
What is the spread for this game?
It's 8.5.
Yeah, that's insane.
There have been some weird Seahawks spreads lately. I mean, that Cowboys -5 spread last week was a bit ridiculous.
It's just crazy to see the Seahawks favored by that much over the Cardinals when we have so much history of these games that Arizona has played in Seattle, especially at the end of the season. I mean, last year we went into that game so confident that the Seahawks were locking up home field.
Yeah, as we discussed on the Year in Review podcast, in that Year in Review, did not see it coming even remotely.
That one ruined our Christmas. This time, the Seahawks have a chance to ruin our New Year's.
Yep.
I'm not going to go into it feeling confident, but also we have to talk about the Falcons.
Yeah, I mean, the New Year's could be ruined even if the Seahawks win. I mean, I think that
By, it'll be less ruined. If the Seahawks win and the Falcons also win, it'll be unfortunate. But if the Seahawks go 10-6 and don't make the playoffs, it's hard to say that was a bad season.
Right. I agree.
Also, yeah. You didn't mention Buda Baker one time when you were talking about the Cardinals' defense.
All right, that's fair. I know loyal listener Jimmy will have some thoughts about that.
And like, Pro Bowler. Buda Baker, Pro Bowler.
Special teams Pro Bowler.
Buda Baker. But also playing a lot of snaps on this. He's starting for the secondary that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be in an even more important, I mean, it won't be more snaps, but an even more important role now with Antoine Bethea's injury.
That's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, Panthers, Falcons. I think that, first off, people are taking for granted the Seahawks beating the Cardinals when they talk about this game.
Yes.
But second off, I don't know. I don't know how people are talking about this game. I think there's a little too much concern about the Panthers pulling their starters and not enough concern about the Falcons just beating the Panthers because they're at home.
Is there talk about the Panthers pulling their starters?
Yeah. So, as you alluded to earlier, the NFL decided not to play a 5:30 Sunday night football game in Week 17 as they traditionally do because what they aim for is a game that doesn't have ramifications on any other game. Like, you know, the ultimate, I think, was the year that the Seahawks played the Rams in 2010 in Week 17 with, like, the NFC West berth on the line at 7-9.
Yeah.
That was so great, but it didn't affect anything else. And so the situation here is if they had flexed Panthers-Falcons to Sunday Night Football, that game might have already become meaningless had the Saints, or at least for the Panthers, well, it could have been meaningless altogether. If the Seahawks lost and the Saints won, then neither team would have anything to play for because they would have been locked in the 5 and 6 seeds. So that's the scenario you don't want. So instead, all of those games will kick off at 1:25 p.m.
Where have you seen this talk about the Panthers sitting their starters?
On Twitter?
From Ron Rivera?
No, I mean, not like actual talk, like Seahawks fans being concerned about it.
Because of any
So Seahawks fans being concerned evidence. That the Saints will take a big lead in Tampa Bay. It will become clear that they are going
Tampa Bay is a capable team, especially at home. Okay.
It will become clear that they are going
We're talking about people who think there's a chance that the Seahawks are trading Russell Wilson. I understand.
And then at halftime, the Panthers will look at the score and pull Cam Newton and other starters at that point to preserve them because they would have nothing to play for. I think that is an unlikely scenario.
The Panthers would be cowards to do that.
Oh, wow. No, it's time for hot takes.
So I think Football Outsiders gives the Seahawks about a 33% chance of making
almost,
the playoffs.
Almost precisely a 1-in-3 chance, yes.
How much of that is the Falcons' chances of beating the Panthers, and how much of that is the Seahawks' chances of losing to the Cardinals?
I am not sure that we can tease that specifically out of the... I guess we'd have to go by expected wins that they have there. So let me look this up.
You just do some math over there really quickly.
I have to. It's more the typing than it is the math necessarily. No, I guess they don't round to decimal. Or no, here we go. Okay, mean wins. Seahawks at 9.6. They give the Seahawks about a 60% chance of winning. So therefore, if they make it 33%, it's a little better than 50-50 of Carolina winning or of Atlanta winning or of Carolina winning.
I mean, I looked at the
Carolina. Yeah,
Carolina DVOA this week sitting at number 8 and Atlanta at number 17. With glee. I mean, we have to realize Atlanta got kind of destroyed by New Orleans last week. Granted, New Orleans is a really good team, but Atlanta's just not that good.
Yeah. I mean, that is true.
I mean, they have a pretty good offense sitting at number 8 and a bad defense, bad special teams. Carolina, if they're trying 100%, I don't know about the scenario of the Panthers resting their starters. If they're trying 100%, I feel like it's about a 50-50 game.
And yet, you know, Football Outsiders says probably something like 56. I mean, again, we're not, you know, this is a rough estimate.
56 for who?
For Carolina. But yet, Atlanta is favored by 4 points. And historically, the best indicator of what's going to happen in Week 17 has been the best indicator of most things, but particularly in Week 17, the advantage for the spreads is exacerbated because of the fact that the market can read in the motivations of teams to win.
Oh.
I mean, look, that doesn't mean that Atlanta is definitely going to win, but I think they are favored to win.
Okay.
I mean, they are favored to win. By definition, they are favored to win. And I think that it is reasonable for them to be favored. Uh-huh.
So last Sunday, it was really nice to be able to... We paid attention to so many things in the morning, and then to be able to hone in on the Seahawks against the Cowboys.
We didn't even really flip around at all.
And this will not be the case.
Line, by the way, down to Atlanta -3.5 as we record this. Should we turn our attention to a game being played at the Arizona Cardinals Stadium? This weekend, Arizona will not be at home. but hopefully Washington will feel at home as they take on Penn State in the Fiesta Bowl.
This one's for all the Tostitos.
Thanks, Brett Musburger. I'm excited for this matchup. If you look at the FPI of the teams, I think this is true if you look at most of the quality advanced metrics. This is the very best matchup outside the college football playoff in any bowl game this year in terms of the combined quality of the two teams. And then probably if you take into account the relative evenness of the two teams, Penn State comes in fourth in the football power index. The Huskies come in seventh. And it's basically considered a toss-up there, with Penn State given a 53% chance of winning. So what I found fascinating in doing the research for this game and thinking about Penn State is kind of the similarities between those two teams.
Yes.
So Penn State faced an even worse non-conference schedule than did the Huskies.
I assume ESPN highlighted that with some tasty treats on the sideline.
Two sub-100 teams out of conference, and then number 55 Pitt, that's in the FPI rankings, is their marquee opponent. Not as good as Fresno State. But much like the Huskies, Penn State dominated this week's slate of opposition, finishing second in the country in point differential to UW's seventh. Their two losses came by a combined 4 points during the middle of the season in back-to-back weeks at Ohio State, 39-38, and then at Michigan State the following week after a 7-0 start. They then responded by winning their last three games to secure a spot in the New Year's Six, including finishing things up with a 66-3 victory over Maryland that really helped goose that point differential.
But you kind of look at their schedule overall, and they had kind of that gauntlet right in the middle, the Michigan, hosting Michigan, at Ohio State, at Michigan State. And then the rest of them were not particularly difficult. I mean, maybe the best team that they faced outside of that was Nebraska, who they got at home and played kind of a close game with. But they definitely got...
Yeah, they did have a few close wins in there. They beat one at Iowa 21-19, and then that Nebraska game... somewhat close-ish.
Which, look, you know, the Huskies needed a miracle to win a game at the end of the season against, that was Utah, right?
Yes.
Look, we can't be talking about close games against lesser foes, but...
Yeah, the one, actually, by the way, Nebraska game wasn't anywhere close. They were up by 32 with 10 minutes left.
Nebraska just... it was close score-wise.
It was a late run.
But Penn State, aside from kind of that chunk, faced a generally pretty easy schedule.
And blew the doors off of it entirely. So that's generally more predictive. I think, you know, if there's one thing that tends to be underrated, it's just dominating teams. That we've talked about this in the past. Whereas the quality of opposition in beating good teams is generally somewhat overrated, especially if you're beating them in close games.
Okay, so tell us about Penn State.
So they're a pretty balanced team, not quite as balanced as UW, which comes into this game in FPI ranked 12th on offense and 13th on defense. You can't get much more balanced than that. Penn State a little better offensively with the 6th ranked offense, the 15th ranked defense, and their one notable advantage here, the 10th ranked special teams to UW's 47th. Although it's weird, I can't really explain why that is per se, because you know the problem with the Huskies was obviously their kicking game. Well, somehow Penn State was even worse at kicking.
Really?
Their kicker, Tyler Davis, went 9 of 16 on field goals this year, although he was a perfect 66 of 66 on extra points, whereas the Huskies had 3 missed extra points by Tristan Vizcaino, and I think they might have had one also by Van Soderberg this year. So I'm not into, and the Huskies are good at everything else in special teams, so is Penn State, but I'm unclear exactly why that difference is so big in FPI.
So Penn State has Saquon Barkley returning kicks for them, averaging 28.4 yards per kick return with 2 touchdowns. That is almost Savon Ahmed-like numbers.
I mean, you joke, but Savon Ahmed has averaged 28.5 yards per kick return this season. Not quite the volume that... Or no, I guess only 5 fewer kicks than Saquon Barkley returned. Yeah, I mean, Saquon Barkley, who was a Heisman contender for much of the season, although he didn't end up going to the ceremony, All-American, highly touted. Yeah, his stats really don't, his rushing stats at least, don't really back it up. He averaged 5.7 yards per carry this season. Myles Gaskin for UW averaged 6.2 on almost identical amount of volume. I've heard this attributed to Penn State's offensive line, and we do know that, you know, offensive lines tend to be underrated in terms of their importance in the rushing game. I do think rushing ability is a real thing at the college level. I mean, at the very least, you can't compare him to Bryce Love, who's like averaging double-digit yards per carry.
Yes. So, you know, if I think there's one place that we can understand why Saquon Barkley had that kind of hype, it's in the receiving game and then also kick returning.
Right. I mean, it's the all-purpose yardage when you start adding all of that up. His 594 receiving yards were the most of any running back in the nation. And even though, you know, there was a lot of volume with 47 catches, his 12.6 yards per catch were also very good. So I think that's probably going to be a place where he can have more success against the Huskies, who, of course, come in as one of the nation's best defenses against the run, allowing just 2.7 yards per carry over the course of the season. And just two teams all season went, just two running backs, rather, had more than 5 yards per carry with at least 10 carries or more than 80 yards against them, those both being the same two players. The aforementioned Bryce Love, who averaged 5.5 yards per carry in Stanford's win, and then Royce Freeman from Oregon, who averaged 5.1 yards per carry against them. So I really think that it might make some sense, you know, if you're going up against a team that finished with the number one rush defense on a per-play basis in the country, to try to get Barkley involved as a receiver instead of as a runner.
Yeah, I mean, I look at a couple of the losses that Penn State had this year. There was the game against Ohio State, their first loss of the year. Saquon Barkley was averaged 2.1 yards per carry on the ground in that game, still ran the ball 21 times, where maybe they probably should have turned away from the run at that point. And then Michigan State, the game that they lost the following week, he was at 4.5 yards per carry. So not terrible, but still not at the same level that he averaged for the season.
And this is not a team that, you know, is exclusively dependent on running the football to be successful. I mean, their junior quarterback, Trace McSorley, a dual-threat quarterback, completed 65% of his passes for 8.4 yards per attempt, had 26 touchdowns, 8 interceptions, and notably, among 3,000-yard passers, his 431 rushing yards ranked third among that group. So you add it all up, he ranked 11th in QBR, and that is going to be far and away the best-ranked quarterback the Huskies have faced all season. If you look at qualifiers, since KJ Costello from Stanford didn't have enough plays to qualify this season, the highest ranked quarterback the Huskies faced all year was Josh Rosen at 41st.
Wow.
Because it's interesting, the top four quarterbacks in the Pac-12, Khalil Tate, number one in the country in QBR.
In everything.
11.3 yards per carry. Khalil Tate is just a freak. Not on the schedule. Number two was
Darnold.
Darnold, not on the schedule. Number three was Justin Herbert, who didn't play against UWs. He was injured. And number four was Jake Browning, who the Huskies only faced in practice.
One more games. So it's kind of weird to look at Penn State, because when I look at them statistically, I think about run game, getting the run game to Barkley, getting the ball to Barkley out of the backfield, but then also passing deep. I mean, mm-hmm. You look at some of the yards per attempt or the yards per catch for their receivers. They've got Deshaun Hamilton at 15.6 yards per reception. They've got DeAndre Tompkins at 15.5 yards per reception. Saeed Blacknall at 16.8 yards per reception. These are way more than almost any Husky receiver who had more than one or two receptions. But still, Trace McSorley averaging less yards per attempt than Jake Browning. I don't understand how that works out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to some extent to the value, you know, when you, as we talked about with Arizona, when you attempt that many deep passes, you're not going to complete as high a percentage of them. And so Jake Browning's at almost 69%, which is somewhat better than Trace McSorley's 65% completion percentage. And he did end up, you know, McSorley did end up slightly better in terms of yards per attempt at 8.4 to Browning's 8.3.
But then also Trace McSorley on the ground.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, you know, 431 rushing yards doesn't sound that great, but when you consider that sacks count as rushing yards in college football, it's actually pretty good. You know, his yards per carry is an actual runner, much better than 3.4 he's listed at. I mean, the other thing that stands out about the Penn State passing game is how balanced it is. They have 5 receivers with at least 400 yards this year. The Huskies have what? Dante Pettis. And someone to watch that you didn't mention earlier in terms of the yards per attempt, their underneath threat is their tight end Mike Gesicki, who has 9 touchdowns this year, a major goal line threat at 6'6", could cause some problems for the Huskies along the same way that we saw J.J. Arcega-Whiteside do so in the Stanford game. Yeah, you're still upset about that.
What about the Huskies on offense?
So, you know, this Penn State defense, overall, They're not quite as good on a per play basis, I would say, as the Huskies. Fairly similar passing defensive stats. They haven't been as stout against the run. I mean, they're giving up 3.4 yards per carry. Let's not act like they're doing bad. It's just UW is the best in the country. So the main thing that has been the strength of this Penn State defense more than anything else is their ability to force defense turnovers. They're averaging 2 turnovers per game, which ranks 14th in the country. The Huskies have only had 2 turnovers in the game twice all season, Fresno State and UCLA. So, you know, if Jake Browning can play a clean game here, if they avoid fumbles, then, you know, maybe there's the opportunity to sustain some drives against this Penn State defense. And I don't want to say expose them a little bit, but, you know, not have them be quite as dominant as they were against teams that were turnover prone. An interesting thing to watch for the Huskies offense in this game is the potential return of Hunter Bryant coming back for the first time since midseason. He's been practicing with the team this week in Phoenix, and he would really bring a dimension to the offense that they lacked in the second half of the year when they were not always an explosive offense.
Don't talk bad about Thrill Dissly.
Look, I Thrill Dissly is a complimentary piece. Very important. He's not Hunter Bryant. Hunter Bryant is just straight up a receiver. He's their number 2 receiver.
Yes.
Behind Dante Pettis.
No, it'd be huge to have him back. I mean, UW is a much more injured team than Penn State in this game.
Very much so. I mean, just a couple injuries for Penn State. They have a player out for the year, and that's pretty much, you know, it. The other interesting thing to watch, I think, will be how the Huskies play on offense without Jonathan Smith in this game. So it's kind of this weird thing where Butch Hamden he's busy trying to keep the Seahawks out of the playoffs as the quarterback coach down in Atlanta this week. Well, Jonathan Smith is already gone. So they've got this weird 1 week here where they're going to be turning over the play calling duties to their co-offensive coordinator, who did get the job subsequently, which seemed a little weird, but you know, this will be a week for Matt Lubick to go out there,
show what he's got, or try to take down the team from the inside.
I don't think he's going to change the team. He's still got a job. He's just not going to be the offensive coordinator. And then also talked about having a lot of input from Jake Browning into the play calling this week, which will be interesting. Yeah. I mean, Coach Pete himself has been working with the quarterbacks since Jonathan Smith also served in that role.
Really? I mean, I'm not expecting the offense to look all that different for this game.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to make dramatic changes, but it'll be interesting to see what, if anything, they add with several weeks of practice time. You know, does that change the way you utilize Savon Ahmed at all?
Man, I hope so.
I know you hope so. Everyone knows you hope so.
But you also have to watch Penn State with trick plays also. Saquon Barkley, not a bad passer.
Yep. Yep.
I'm sure that that's something that they're studying. What do you expect to happen in this game?
I would say that studying Penn State made me feel somewhat less confident about this game.
Really?
Like, I like their mix of talent. They're quite good. I mean, their offense is terrific. There's not like a clear place where the Huskies, you know, have a dramatic edge in this game. I mean, maybe it's rush defense, and maybe they take Saquon Barkley out of the game and make Penn State one-dimensional and can be successful that way. I think, you know, as you alluded to earlier, that's kind of the formula for success for them here. But I think this is probably going to be, even though these teams are both very good defensively, I think this is going to be closer to a shootout.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it's partially just because we saw it last year between USC and Penn State, and you can kind of plug in UW and say, maybe these look a little bit similar. Penn State's a very similar team to what they were a year ago.
Yeah.
And kind of in a very similar position, I think there's going to be a lot of points scored in this game. I think Myles Gaskin is going to have a huge game in particular. I think the Huskies are going to go into it wanting to run the ball, and I think they're going to run the ball pretty successfully. You know, maybe they get Ahmed involved. If LaVon Coleman plays, maybe he'll be involved. But I think Myles Gaskin is going to have a big game in this one, and the Huskies are going to move the ball, but their defense will probably be pushed more than it has been almost in the entire season.
I mean, again, we talked about this. They've not faced a quarterback like this. KJ Costello is not a quarterback like this, with all due respect.
That's who we're talking about. Somebody who's not the starter for Stanford.
I know. But that's like,
we're like, well, at least they faced KJ Costello.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of crazy to consider that Josh Rosen is potentially maybe the top pick in the draft. And
well, that's a podcast for another day, I think. Maybe a pre-draft podcast.
But that he's not somebody who's kind of at the same level as Trace McSorley, who to me looks like a pretty complete all-around quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, he's like very unconventional watching him play. He looks like, he doesn't like look like a stereotypical quarterback. He's kind of undersized and slings the ball when he's out there.
I kind of like him. Yeah, me too. I kind of like Trace McSorley.
Yeah.
I'm just excited to watch this game, though. I mean, the fact that we have this opportunity, I've talked about this over and over and over again, that we have this opportunity to see the Huskies play a big program on a big stage is just an awesome opportunity, and I think it's going to be a close one. It's going to be a fun game to watch, and I think the Huskies have a little bit less than a 50% chance to win. I'm going to say 45%.
I also am saying 45%. Yeah, I mean, this is a team that they've only faced twice in school history, the 1983 Aloha Bowl, and then, of course, I'm sure you remember 1921 matchup in Seattle, which was the first trip ever for Penn State out to the West Coast.
1921 revenge game.
Yes. Penn State has won both of those matchups so far, so Huskies looking for their first ever
they
win.
Know this is their house. They know this is their home field.
I mean, I guess I was gonna, yeah, the Huskies have more experience playing in Arizona, although it usually doesn't go well for the Huskies in Arizona, so hopefully better than that. All right, well, it should be a fun one. And on that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.